Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, live from the WNYC studios in Soho. Thank you for sharing part of your day with us. We continue our conversation about female artists' place in art history with Katie Hessel, author of The Story of Art Without Men. The title is a take on the tome that for years was considered the book on art by H. Gombrich, titled The Story of Art. The problem is the first edition of that 650-page book contained no women, and in 16 subsequent editions, there's only one woman, Kathy Kollwitz, famous for her work in response to World War I. She is featured in Hessel's book, too, along with hundreds of other female artists from around the world. Katie Hessel writes in her introduction, quote, "The canon of art history is global. However, with the male Western narrative being so unjustly dominant at the expense of others, it is this that I unpack and challenge." Today, we'll discuss part two of The Story of Art Without Men. This section is titled What Made Art Modern, and it covers the years 1870 to 1950. It's an exploration of the Paris avant-garde movement, the role of identity, and the rise of modernism in America. Let's talk about the Impressionists. What was the catalyst for Impressionism?
So the Impressionism really came about because of, you know, the changes in modernity. You know, modernity was in the air at this time. You know, not only were artists, not only were sort of the likes of trains invented, you know, life they could suddenly experience at this new speed. You know, this idea that the world was being built up around them. In Paris, it was the era of Haussmannization, with Haussmann, when he completely reconfigured Paris with these kind of sprawling boulevards and new streets and new buildings. He built it for this kind of new bourgeoisie and this new society and this new world. And, you know, this was the era where paint tubes were invented, and the fact that artists for the first time ever could work outside, in other words, work plein air. And what happened with Impressionism is that suddenly the sort of fashions changed from these kind of academic, grand, historical, biblical paintings, which is kind of ironic when we think about the fact that women were finally admitted to the life room, but the fashions changed these kind of scenes of everyday life, because it was about capturing modernity in all its kind of fleeting glory. And so suddenly as well, because of the invention of photography and the invention of the moving image, suddenly, you know, painting doesn't become about realism anymore. It becomes about capturing an impression of something, which is how the world's Impressionism came about. And the Impressionists really kind of rebelled against the academic society, and they formed their own exhibitions away from the salons. And at first they were kind of met with hostility, but really they revolutionized art history, because this kind of long line of isms such as futurism, surrealism, dadaism, post-impressionism, all these movements kind of fell after that. But Impressionism was incredible because really, they captured modernity through paint. It was almost like trying to capture this intangible feeling of what it was like to witness the speed of modernity. And one of the foremost artists during this time was Berthe Morisot. And she was the first female artist to be part of the Impressionist exhibition. She was in the first ever one. And, you know, what she did as well is she gave life and she gave voice to what a woman in the sort of late 19th century in France was going through. Because, you know, I really sort of talk about this idea of modernity in my book as, you know, what does modernity even mean? You know, this idea of lines shattered on a canvas, you know, this breakaway from the past, these kind of eradication of hierarchies between art form, but also what makes art modern is the participation of women artists and the liberation in which they could paint. And what we see with Berthe Morisot is, although she was from an upper class family, she gave voice to actually the restrictions that women still face in society. She often painted her sister Edma, who had to actually renounce her artistic career in favor of marriage. And so she often sort of painted the complications of that. You know, the complications of being, striving to be a modern woman, but at the same time, you know, being a mother as well. And actually what she did is she gave voice to that.
So in the Met's description of Morisot's work, Young Woman Seated on a Couch, it contains a mention of her brother-in-law, Edouard Manet. And he allegedly said of the Morisot sisters, quote, "It's annoying they're not men." Edward Manet wrote to fellow artist Henri Fantin-Latour after meeting Berthe and Edmond Morisot, two sisters from the Parisian upper crust who were promising painters. He found them, quote, "charming," and feared that because they were women, their accomplishments would inevitably go to waste.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned this because there's also a fantastic quote that one tutor of Edmer and Berthe Morisot, who was so stunned and shocked by the sisters' talent, he reported to their parents, you know, he said, "Your daughters have such inclinations that my teaching will not give them merely the talent of pleasing. They will become painters. Do you know what this means? In your environment, this will be a revolution, if not a catastrophe." And I think it's this idea that, you know, everything was shifting during this time. You know, women were sort of given the vote imminently. You know, everything changed during and after the First World War because of the many men who went to battle and the women who had to take on these roles of their own. And, you know, of course they were at a disadvantage because they were women. But actually, thanks to people like Berthe Morisot and Mary Cassatt, and really they broke through and encouraged other artists to also pick up a brush and actually tell their story on their own terms.
My guest is Katie Hessel. We're talking about her book, The Story of Art Without Men. I would like to ask you about, is it Paula Morrison Becker?
Yes.
All right. So she was an artist who was able to study from a nude, which apparently was quite a thing. I'll use that's not the most eloquent way to say it, but quite a thing. when were women allowed to do this? How long did it take for women to be able to paint from a nude, which is, you know, just a very classic form of art training?
I mean, really, it sort of began in the sort of mid-19th century, in a way, because there were some women from the upper classes who could have access to that nude, who could have access to a nude figure. But I've got this great quote, because what happened also in the 19th century was, you know, the opening up of art schools as well. And one artist, Evelyn de Morgan, you know, she attended the Slade School of Art in the 1870s. And, you know, it's the fact that when she had access to the life room, there was actually a curfew of 5 p.m., which is ridiculous, because you kind of think, like, what is happening after 5 p.m. in these kind of life rooms? But Paula Morrison Becker was part of the kind of German Expressionism movement, or was almost kind of before that. And, you know, it's tragic because she only survived until she was 31 years old. And, you know, she was born in 1876 and she died in 1907. And during that era, I mean, women sort of went from hardly any opportunity to so much more opportunity. And you kind of think, you know, Berthe Morisot also died very young at 45, I think a couple of years before Paula Morrison Becker. And you just think, my God, what these women would have achieved had they had access to the kind of early years of the 20th century, because it's then that we see shifts happening just at a rapid pace. I mean, not only with artists, but with all different professions, with women. But with Paula Morrison Becker, she had, worked in a way that was really radical. She was born in Bremen in Germany, and she sort of settled in 1898 when she was 22 years old in Worpswede, which was an art colony in the North German moors, where a group of German artists devoted themselves to painting kind of lyrical naturalism. But really, she wanted more. And on the 1st of January 1900, she made a 17-hour train journey to Paris. And it was a trip that would change her life. You know, she was stifled by the Worpswede art colony because she didn't want to paint the natural landscape. She wanted to paint the nude figure. She wanted to go to the classes of the Academy Colarossi. And she wanted to study the kind of classical busts and figures in the Louvre. She writes in her journal, you know, in 1906, you know, I am living the most intensely happy time of my life. And really, Paris was this place for women where they could experiment and they could be, you know, they could become something. But, you know, unfortunately, with limited finances, you know, she hardly sold anything during her life. She was kind of lured back to Worpswede by her husband and gave birth the following November to a daughter, Mathilde, but due to complications, died just a few weeks later. And it's the fact that she didn't even live to see her success. You know, in 1927, the Paula Modersohn Becker Museum opened in Bremen, the first ever museum to be in Europe dedicated to a female painter. And it's as though she kind of died on the cusp of modernity. And she was the first, she's the first known artist in Western art history to paint herself semi-nude. And this idea of what does that mean to sort of immortalize yourself like that?
I would like to ask you about Georgette Chen, who was someone who worked and lived in Paris. She was born in China. How do we see her multicultural life in her work?
Georgette Chen made the most beautiful self-portraits and paintings of all different kinds of subjects during her life. And I think what we see here is this woman who straddled two worlds, you know, living between Europe and Asia, being able to see the world. You know, we have to remember that the globalization was so minimal 100 years ago. And it's the fact that, you know, to even travel was such a revolutionary act. And she would have seen so much. And also what she does is she kind of, you know, she blends her Asian heritage with the kind of style of the French modernists, which makes her remarkable. You know, it's the fact that she was trained in Shanghai by a Russian tutor. You know, she studied in New York, later Paris. And it's an education that no doubt influenced her distinctive blending of styles. You know, there's a great quote in my book, I say, by her. She says, although I belong to the modern school, I feel that I am not able to imitate any specific style. I paint what I see, whether it be a landscape or a figure. And that's what we see in her work, because they feel so contemporary. You know, she's giving voice to who she is on her terms, you know, through her radical self-portraits, because even just to paint yourself is a radical act.
My guest is Katie Hessel. The name of her book is The Story of Art Without Men. So the New York Times, I'm sure you know, has this series called Overlooked, and they go back and they write obituaries for people who probably should have had them written at the time of their lives, their passing. And there was one for the artist Amrita Shergill, who's in your book. And she's described this way in the Times Overlooked obituary: a pioneer of modern Indian art, used her paintbrush to depict the daily lives of Indian women in the 1930s, often revealing a sense of their loneliness, even hopelessness. So she painted in Paris, but she didn't stay. Why didn't she stay in Paris? How did it impact her work?
Well, the thing about, I mean, it's such a fantastic series, Overlooked. And actually, I reference so many of the obituaries because they're so brilliant for, you know, I remember looking at Edmonia Lewis's, Deanne Arbus, because I think when Deanne Arbus died, there was only about sort of four lines or four words or something in the New York Times, which is sort of a travesty and unthinkable today. But with Amrita Shergill, you know, she was from, you know, she had Indian heritage. And in 1934, she said, you know, I can only paint in India. Europe belongs to Picasso, Matisse, and many others. India belongs to me. And it's this idea that, you know, she again, you know, died so young. She was only about 28 years old when she died. And during her sort of decade-long career, she achieved so much. You know, she studied at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. She was the first Indian student to do so. You know, she worked in a European style. Again, you know, putting those stories and the stories of her own experience into those works, but really she abandoned her European style. And her figurative works really kind of transformed into these studies of saturated color. And I think it's really in that sort of mid to later 1930s that we see someone who has found her style, and this idea that her work is also very quiet. You know, I talk about this work, but sort of quietly powerful as well. I talk about this work called Three Girls in my book. And Three Girls is this extraordinary work of, you know, three girls who are sort of looking reflective. And it's as though she's sort of capturing, because she, you know, she was in her sort of mid-20s at this point, of a sort of turning point in her life. You know, this kind of idea from going from a girl or a young woman to a woman, and actually what that means. You know, what does it mean to maybe get married? What does it mean? And especially, you know, we think about 100 years ago, that was very different. And so oftentimes she's giving voice to these very sort of reflective stories, which again feels so contemporary as well. But she also, you know, she spoke so sensitively to sort of local villagers and market goers as well.
In the book, you spend some time on queer identity Who was an artist, a woman who embraced her queer identity, their queer identity, and who's someone who felt the need to hide it?
That's a great question. I mean, really, I have a chapter called Queer Identities in my book because there's a reason for that. It's because I feel that in history books, it hasn't been spotlighted mm-hmm. as much as it has. And actually, you know, I look at tons of queer artists throughout the book, whether it be Rosa Bonheur or Hannah Hawk or so many others. But I gave sort of precedent to a particular group of artists who are working in the kind of beginning of the 20th century who really were expressing, you know, outwardly expressing their queer identity and actually immortalizing that through painting. Because, you know, so much of the time, you know, lesbianism was silenced, especially in England. But in Paris, you know, thanks to the likes of sort of Natalie Barney, you know, with her salons and everything, and Marie Laurencin and all these extraordinary artists, Romaine Brooks, you know, it was something that was celebrated. You know, this idea of sexual freedoms was completely rife in Paris in the kind of 1910s and 1920s. It was really a sort of period of liberation. And, you know, this idea of expressing queer identity in art is a very sort of conflicting one, because at one time, you know, if I look at someone called Gluck, who was an extraordinary artist in the early 20th century, you know, Gluck's, you know, was brought up in a sort of very wealthy conservative Jewish family who really disapproved of not only their child's artistic ambitions, but also their androgynous look. And they really sort of cut their hair and wore these amazing sharp suits. And that was such a statement during that time as well. And, you know, not only did they paint themselves they painted one of the first sapphic portraits in history of themselves mm. and their lover, Nesta, which is a gorgeous painting, which sort of shows, it's called You, We Medallion. And it's from 1936. And it shows the union between two lovers, but also it's heartbreaking because you can tell that Gluck wants to hold on to Nesta, but Nesta is kind of basking in this sort of auric light, and Nesta's also married. And so it's heartbreaking because Nesta can't fully commit to Gluck, and Gluck sort of knows that, despite them sort of trying to sort of immortalize themselves in this work. But they also paint those around them who were kind of hiding their queerness. So, for example, I've got this work in my book called Ernest Thesiger, and it's this painting of this man who is spotlighted on a stage in a theater, and he's sort of almost suffocated by his suit. It's very sort of tightly painted, and when we look at the shadow, that's even more tightly painted, as if to sort of emphasize the fact that he doesn't want to be this, because he was known, he was a married but homosexual man known to perform in drag, and actually, you know, what Gluck portrayed him, you know, as he would have been accepted by society, you know, in the same suit outfit that would have also emotionally suffocated him. And so what artists are doing at this time, they're giving voice to these people who are silenced by society. You know, we're still in such a sort of crisis around the world, but you could imagine 100 years ago, it was so daring to paint something like that.
When surrealism arrived or became more popular, what did it offer the female artist?
Well, surrealism really was a movement that, you know, was built on the anti-establishment notions of Dada, you know, in the wake of political crisis and the sort of traumas of the First World War. And what surrealism offered artists, especially women, was this sort of anti-establishment excitement to sort of make it their own. You know, it wasn't about reality, it was about the inner world. But of course, it was also a movement, when we think about the male artists, you know, they really sort of brutalized the female body, because although it was founded, you know, although it was appealing to women due to its sort of projected ethos of equality and radical and progressive thought, it was not entirely true. You know, Breton wrote in his 1929 manifesto, the problem of woman was the most marvelous and disturbing problem in all the world. But what was amazing about the women artists of this movement is that they didn't care about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got this great quote by in my book, you know, Roland Penrose, who was the husband of Lee Miller, a great photographer, when he was visiting, when Whitney Chadwick, a great feminist art historian, visited him in the 1980s, he said, "Of course the women were important, but it was because they were our muses. They weren't artists." And actually, when Whitney Chadwick later asked Leonora Carrington for her thoughts on the surrealist muse, she replied, "I thought it was bullshit. I didn't have time to be anyone's muse. I was too busy rebelling against my family and learning to be an artist. So although these misogynistic sort of values were sort of put in place, these women sort of took no notice of it. You know, the likes of Lee Miller traveled the world. Leonor Feeney traveled from Buenos Aires to Europe and sort of immortalized herself as this kind of proto-punk woman. I all looked at the Sphinx. And it's the fact that actually what surrealism offered was this other world and this sort of also alchemical world, this idea of transformation. Actually, can we transform into this other world? Can we break away from society's rigidity and immortalize ourselves as something else? You know, so much of the artists, they traveled across the globe, whether it would be sort of Leonora Carrington escaping her sort of debutante lifestyle in England, running away to Paris via Madrid, then to New York, and then settling in Mexico City for the rest of her life. These women were independent. They were rebellious. They painted on their terms. So although it was sort of inherently misogynistic, they found a way to sort of make it their own.
I wanted to ask about the Harlem Renaissance, because I think when people think about the Harlem Renaissance, they think about writers and performers. Who were some of the artists, the female artists, we can trace back to the Harlem Renaissance?
Oh my gosh. I mean, you know, this was such a rich time for so many of the different arts, whether it be literature, music, poetry, the visual arts. But really what was extraordinary was the women of this era, especially the artists, were not only profound artists making work that is extraordinary, but actually they were all such advocates for education. And one artist I concentrate on is someone called Augusta Savage, who, you know, was born in 1892. She was raised in a strict family in Florida with a father who sort of opposed her artistic pursuits. And she came to New York City with just $4.60 in her pocket. And what she did, she absolutely thrived. She enrolled at Cooper Union. And in the sort of 1920s, she really came to the fore. And she kind of mastered these emotionally tender and stoic life-size, but also portrait busts of local people, of sort of local scholars, but also unknown people as well. And I love the fact that although she worked in plaster, she would actually use shoe polish to create a bronze effect. And I love the fact that it doesn't matter, you know, this idea of what does great art mean anyway? Does it mean that we have to use marble or bronze? No, we can use any material, whatever we have access to. But really, she was an advocate for education, having herself been denied a scholarship on the grounds of her race. And so she, although she did make it to Paris eventually, she was an advocate for equality. She opened cultural centers. She owned, she owned galleries. She championed African-American painters of her generation and those in the generation below her as well, and really uplifted. She taught the likes of Gwendolyn Knight, Jacob Lawrence, but also her break came in 1937 when she was commissioned by the World's Fair to create this work called The Harp, which was originally called Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was this remarkable work that stood in the center of the World's Fair at 16 foot high, which was designed to sort of showcase the contribution to music by African Americans. And it's absolutely beautiful. It shows these children almost sort of in this chorus, their robes sort of evoking the instrument strings, and almost sort of sitting, almost standing in the palm of God's hand. And although it was a work that earned her national press coverage, due to lack of funding and storage costs, it was destroyed after the fair. And so we think about the kind of legacy and impact this work might have had then, but also the generations beyond and now. And so really, although these women existed and their stories are remarkable and their works are remarkable, you know, they weren't given the right access and funding, which is why we are still finding out about so many now.
On tomorrow's conversation about the story of art without men, we'll speak with the historian Katie Hessel about New York's own Ninth Street Women and the Guerrilla Girls.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.